This hour's top stories. Russia says its ties with the U.S. and Europe have hit the bottom. The U.S.-led pressure on Moscow has absolutely no chance for success. Two paramedics give moving testimonies during the fourth day of the trial of a former U.S. white police officer charged with the murder of African-American George Floyd.
In lay terms, I thought he was dead.
And a train derails in a tunnel in eastern Taiwan, leaving at least 36 people dead and dozens more injured. Welcome to the program. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov says his country's ties with the U.S. and Europe have hit the bottom. Lavrov criticized U.S. President Joe Biden for calling his Russian counterpart a killer. Lavrov said the remarks were appalling and forced Moscow to rethink its ties with Washington. The top Russian diplomat also said the U.S.-led pressure on Russia has absolutely no chance for success. Lavrov made the comments in a televised speech. He also blamed the European Union for the collapse of its ties with Russia. He said the bloc is eager to toe the U.S. policy on Moscow. Russia's relations with the West, as you know, have soured in the past several years over a range of issues, including election meddling and human rights. On to our second headline story this hour, the fourth day of the trial of former U.S. white police officer Derek Chauvin has been held. He's charged with the killing of unarmed African-American George Floyd in Minneapolis last year.
When you say palpate, is that you didn't feel or detect a pulse?
Yeah, I did not detect a pulse.
And what did his condition appear to be to you overall?
In lay terms, I thought he was dead.
Because he was, I guess limp would be the best description. He wasn't, he was unresponsive and wasn't holding his head up or anything like that.
When Mr. Floyd was no longer offering up any resistance to the officers, they could have ended their restraint.
And that was after he was handcuffed and on the ground and no longer resisting?
Correct.
Thank you. I have no further questions, Your Honor.
Plugger was Derek Chauvin's shift supervisor on the day of Mr. Floyd's death. The former supervisor also acknowledged receiving a phone call from an emergency service dispatcher. During the call, the dispatcher had expressed concern about the use of force after observing a group of police officers on a surveillance camera. Derek Chauvin killed Floyd last May by kneeling on his neck for nearly 9 minutes. Chauvin's lawyers say he followed his police training and is not guilty of the charges. Floyd's death sparked months of anti-racism protests in the U.S. Well, let's discuss this a little bit further with seasoned broadcaster and journalist Mr. Teta Kofi. He joins us via Skype, I believe, out of London. Quite moving revelations, at least the one towards the end that I listened to very carefully. What do they tell you?
Well, what they say is that if indeed Derek Chauvin followed the training he'd received to the letter of the law, then the police is being trained to become a genocidal force. Because everybody else that we've spoken to, and we're constantly taking box, most of us journalists here in London, of what people think of the footage and so on that's being released, is that most people are calling it an absolute horror show. Mm-hmm. And that unless you have no sense of a person's humanity, then you can watch this thing completely dispassionately. It is for most people a traumatizing experience to watch the tape.
And what kind of accountability? I mean, I believe, Teta, that it's a good thing that you have a trial, and that was only after people made a lot of noise about this. But don't you think that we're talking about, you know, countries that, I mean, you know better than I that this is not the first time this is happening, and if it was not because of the noise that the people made, such a court wouldn't even be held in the first place. Now, what does that tell you about the justice system, especially the ones that are held for people of black community or people of color in the U.S.?
You see, the irony of this is that, if I may flip to the United Kingdom just for a moment.
Sure.
We've just had the biggest report on racial disparities in the United Kingdom. And Boris Johnson, the Prime Minister's appointed lead on race matters, is basically saying that there's nothing here to see. Britain is not institutionally racist. And what is interesting is that that has led to the most fantastic backlash from the black community within the United Kingdom, because the person who was put up to write that report, and who I know very well, was actually black. Hmm. Now, a similar narrative is attempted everywhere black people exist as a minority. Nothing to see here. We follow the letter of the law. Tragic accident. Well, I don't think it's going to go away. Mm-hmm. And it's not going to go away because a number of other things have conspired to put this thing right in the crosshairs of people's consciousness, not least of all, a COVID pandemic mm-hmm. that certainly in my city of origin, which is London, kills a person who looks like me mm-hmm. two times more than a person who looks Caucasian.
That's horrible. Tete, tell me something else. You know, back to what's happening in the U.S., you know, it's not so far away, 50, 60 years ago, back in the 60s, that they had, you know, the separation for the black community and the restaurants, you name it. And during the past 50, 60 years, you see such a behavior that happens every once in a while. And, you know, even last year, I mean, Mr. Floyd was the one who was killed, but, you know, we had some other people of African origin who were shot. And, you know, the instances, if I'm not mistaken, were 5-6 at least. Now you have the Asian community that, you know, is being targeted. It seems that, you know, people who were in charge in the United States haven't done a really good homework, haven't done a really good job of bringing or people on equal terms, you know, bringing that kind of justice that they say the U.S. stands for. Whose fault is it, really? You know, it seems that it's not just black people.
Well, you know, I've always thought that before you solve a problem, you've got to identify what the problem is. American culture is predicated on a system of race, which creates a totem pole indicating that the lighter skinned you are, the more you are near the top. But things are beginning to change. For example, the best educated ethnic group in the whole of the United States are Nigerian Americans. Mm. Now, when that sort of thing starts to happen, the privileges which were nailed on for people purely and simply on account of the old system of race start to feel threatened. And so what we're seeing is a reaction, if you like, and an attempt to put people back in the boxes which the majority feel they have escaped from. So in this reaction to retain a system of racial hierarchy, we're seeing these things happen. Now it's been extended to China, to people who look Asiatic. And all it took was for one very verbose president to come out and name a flu after China.
Yeah.
And it just shows that kind of xenophobia was only skin deep. I mean, scratch it and poof, the whole thing comes up in public. So is it a question of whether the leaders have failed to lance the boil, or is it a question of Americans themselves are beginning to recognize who they are and how they are mm-hmm. because they've been in denial of it all this time? Mm-hmm. It seems that people hate to be called racist more than they hate racism itself.
Very interesting.
That's what we're going through right now.
Very interesting take. That's Tete Kofi, broadcaster and journalist, seasoned one for that matter, out of London. I really appreciate speaking to you, sir. Thank you. Have a good day. pack train has derailed inside a tunnel in eastern Taiwan and leaving at least 36 people dead. Authorities say dozens more have been injured. Some reports say the death toll could be higher. Taiwan media say a truck that was parked properly was suspected of sliding into the path of the train. It was traveling from Taipei to Taitung, carrying more than 300 people. Nearly a third of them have already been evacuated. Rescue efforts are ongoing to get access to the carriages inside the tunnel. Officials say they have deformed and are hard to gain access to. Dutch Prime Minister Mark Rutte has narrowly won a no-confidence vote in Parliament over claims he lied about coalition talks. Following the vote, Rutte promised to work terribly hard to regain trust. He was accused of covering up efforts to rein in an outspoken lawmaker, during coalition negotiations. It all began last week when the talks halted after one negotiator unwittingly revealed the documents to a news photographer. That happened as the negotiator rushed out of Parliament. The document is set to show that Premier Rutte discussed making the MP a minister. At that time, Rutte said he had not discussed that, but he later said that he had remembered that wrong. Rutte's party won the most seats in last month's elections in the Netherlands. A UK charity says the government's recent race report has ignored what it called the brutal evidence of economic inequality. The government report said institutional racism does not occur in the UK. It said the country should be regarded as a model for other white majority nations. Now, Turn to US Charity says the data it has compiled show deep-rooted inequalities in UK society. It says ethnic minorities have suffered significantly greater economic hardship during the pandemic. The charity has provided statistics showing economic disparities between the minorities and the white people. White British people, I might add. The group has urged the British government to not dismiss the reality of institutional racism and make meaningful change.
The Commission on Race and Ethnic Disparities says the UK system is not rigged against people from ethnic minorities and there is no proof of institutional racism. In a report released Wednesday, it did admit that minorities still face overt racism, but insisted Britain should be regarded as a, quote, model for other white majority countries.
The report definitely touched a nerve, suggesting that disparities based on race in the economy and education are negligible. But people here in Brixton definitely disagree.
They live in their little tower and they've grown up in a certain way, but they don't see the reality of what black people are actually going through. So no, there is racism and we are not hung up. We need to just be heard that something is wrong with our bringing up our lives and how we are actually treated. Because in reality, we are seen as a different colour.
Institutional racism does exist. It exists in the education system everywhere. You can see it in a classroom. A teacher would discriminate against a black student over a white student just because he's black.
The report has been slammed as nonsense that flies in the face of all existing evidence. Flagged up are many issues that black and minority ethnics grapple on a daily basis. For example, the fact that black people are 9 times more likely to be stopped and searched by police than white people, and black mothers are 4 times likely to die in childbirth. So is this a genuine effort to understand racism in Britain or a PR stunt? Many black artists share the view that racism today is alive and well. Junior from the British Collective says his life and career were deeply impacted by racism.
When I was a kid and I was growing up, if I played football and a white guy kicked me, I would have turned around and I might have effed him blind. But it wouldn't have crossed my mind to call him white. Vice versa, the first thing that he would do is turn around and say, "You black so-and-so." Not understanding for himself that he's being racist, he just took it as the norm. It hasn't changed since then. It hasn't changed in any shape, form, or fashion. I hear some politicians trying to turn it into, black politicians trying to turn it into a, "Oh, well, we've come a long way." We haven't.
The COVID-19 pandemic and the disproportionate number of deaths among Black, Asian, and minority ethnic people clearly illustrate that something is seriously wrong. Being much more likely to have to live in a block of flats and do a job involving a high level of exposure to the public are the sort of factors that critics say prove systemic or structural racism is real. Bianca Rahimi, London.
British regulators say they have found more cases of rare blood clot events after the use of the AstraZeneca COVID-19 vaccine. Regulators reported 30 such cases on Thursday out of more than 18 million doses given. Last month, they identified 5 cases of blood clots out of 11 million administered shots. The British regulators say they have received no such reports following the use of other COVID vaccines. Some countries are restricting use of the AstraZeneca over the clots that in some cases have led to deaths, but some others have resumed its use after assurances from the World Health Organization. The body says the benefits of the AstraZeneca vaccine outweigh any possible risk of blood clots. The Yemeni army has launched a fresh retaliatory drone strike on targets in Saudi Arabia. Army spokesman Yahya Sari said 2 drones targeted the King Khalid Air Base in the southwestern Saudi city of Khamis Mushait. The Saudi-led coalition claims to have intercepted the drones. The raids come hours after a similar strike that hit the Saudi capital, Riyadh. Yemen says the retaliatory attacks will continue as long as Riyadh's airstrikes and its blockade continue. Saudi Arabia waged its war on Yemen 6 years ago. Tens of thousands of Yemenis, mostly civilians, have lost their lives as a result. Yemen's bloc of anti-aggression parties has held an event in the capital, Sana'a, to discuss the role of Yemeni tribes in facing the Saudi-led coalition forces. The event also highlighted the key role of Yemeni tribes in supporting the army in different fronts across the country. Abdul Latif Al-Washali has more.
As the Yemeni army is pushing ahead with its offensive to liberate the city of Marib from Saudi-backed forces, Yemen's bloc of anti-aggression parties has held an event in the capital Sana'a to discuss the role of the southern and eastern Yemeni tribes in facing the Saudi-led coalition.
Many of the free people in southern Yemen stand beside their country in groups and parties, but they face severe repression from the forces of the coalition in southern regions, which confirms the ugliness of the crimes committed by the coalition against Yemenis. All Yemenis should be working together on a comprehensive plan to liberate all governorates after the liberation of Marib.
Since the beginning of the Saudi war in Yemen, eastern and western tribes played a key role in supporting the Yemeni army with weapons, money, and fighters. The participants say the tribes devoted their efforts to expel the foreign presence from their country.
The southern and eastern Yemeni tribes have many honorable stances, whether by spreading culture and awareness or supporting the political position inside and outside Yemen. They are also supporting the fronts of confrontation with weapons, men, money, and sending food convoys to the fighters on all fronts. The tribes are seeking to expel the foreign occupation from the country.
The Yemeni army has recently intensified its operations to liberate Marib, the last stronghold of the Saudi-backed forces in northern Yemen, a move which considered as the first step forward for liberating the rest of the country.
Yemenis agree that the liberation of the country will not succeed without the tribes backing the army, since the tribes themselves refuse the presence of any foreign forces, especially those of Saudi Arabia. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
And that's it with international news.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Nowruz Special. In the name of God, Salam and welcome to the program. Today is the 13th of Farvardin, which has been named as Nature's Day in Iran. It is the last day of the Nowruz holidays. Stay tuned for a special feature on this occasion. One of the old traditions of the Iranian people on this day is to go to the nature. People go to forests, parks, and mountains on this day to enjoy the beauties of spring on the concluding day of the Nowruz holidays. It is a day for gathering together and sharing happy moments with one another. It symbolizes man's unity with the nature. This unity is one of the main elements of Iranian feasts. If we survey the ancient Iranian traditions, we will find many feasts and customs that indicate unity and bond with each other. The global campaign against environment pollution has begun for less than two decades, while the Iranian nation has loved nature for several millennia. Iranians have always tried to preserve the nature and refrain from contaminating the nature and living environment. This has been strengthened by the Islamic teachings, as the leaders of this religion have put great emphasis on safeguarding the nature as the gift of God. According to the ancient Iranian traditions, the first 12 days of Nowruz were the symbol of 12,000 years of creation. Thus, on the 13th day, people go to the nature to gain new energy for better work and activity. There are many narrations on the 13th of Farvardin. The world-famous Iranian polymath, Abu Rayhan Biruni, was among the first people to study human customs. He can be called the pioneer of anthropology. Biruni says in his book, Al-Baghia, ancient Iranians used to call each day of the month with a specific name, and the 13th day of each month was called Tiruz. Tir is the name of a dear angel and a great, radiant, and auspicious star. Therefore, Tiruz means the 13th day of the month and a happy day for Iranians. Moreover, it has been mentioned in the Iranian myth that on this day and the fourth month of the year, that is, Tir, the borders of Iran and Turan, Central Asia and Transoxiana had been determined by the legendary Arash. Today, people get out of homes to enjoy themselves beside relatives and friends on the last day of Nowruz holidays, regardless of superstitions. People on this day go to the nature and try to entertain in forests, gardens, parks, and by riverbanks and mountain sites. Most people engage in gregarious games and try to prepare food together. Some families prepare swings by tying ropes to robots and old trees. These swings are mostly used by children and adolescents. As it was said, people make the food together, but women play a great role in making special foods for this day. Families take the remainder of Nowruz knots to the nature to finish them. Some of the ethnicities in the west of the country make kufte for this day. Kufte is a special food that is made with round lumps of meat mixed with vegetables and grains and cooked in water. Rice and fish is also common on this day. However, one of the common foods on this day is ash, which is used for a series of Iranian soups that are made with a variety of vegetables and legumes. The special ash for 13th of Farvardin is usually prepared in the nature with different herbs that are gathered from the nature. Yet, ash reshte is one of the very popular foods on this day. In the south Khorasan province, in the east of Iran, and Yazd province, in the center of the country, women usually prepare a kind of bread on this day with flour, oil, and sesame seeds. In the north of the country, various kinds of halwa are prepared for this day. One of the very common customs on this day is to eat lettuce with a kind of tasty syrup called sekanjabin. Sekanjabin is composed of sugar, vinegar, and mint essence. Lettuce and sekanjabin are usually eaten in the afternoon of this day. Some families throw their green sprouts in rivers and running water, although this custom has no logical background. This year, like the previous one, people might not gather together as they used to before the coronavirus outbreak, but they try to enjoy the last day of Nowruz holidays even if they stay at home.
The debate.
Hello, everyone. Warm welcome to the debate show. I'm your host, Usna Shafi. There was backlash in Britain today over a government-commissioned report that critics argue whitewashes the state of race relations in the country. The Prime Minister's most senior black advisor has also resigned, but number 10 Downing Street saying it's got nothing to do with the report. Divisive, insulting, and deeply cynical are the words that critics have used to describe that report. Prime Minister Johnson has acknowledged serious issues exist as regards racism in Britain that need to be addressed. The question is, how deep-rooted is racism in the UK? Is the problem there to stay? Let's begin this debate with this report.
The Commission on Race and Ethnic Disparities says the UK system is not rigged against people from ethnic minorities and there is no proof of institutional racism. In a report released Wednesday, it did admit that minorities still face overt racism but insisted Britain should be regarded as a, quote, model for other white-majority countries. The report definitely touched a nerve, suggesting that disparities based on race in the economy and education are negligible. But people here in Brixton definitely disagree.
They live in their little tower and they've grown up in a certain way, but they don't see the reality of what black people are actually going through. So no, there is racism and we are not hung up. We need to just be heard that something is wrong with our bringing up our lives and how we are actually treated. Because in reality, we are seen as a different colour.
Institutional racism does exist. It exists in the education system everywhere. You can see it in a classroom. A teacher would discriminate against a black student over a white student just because he's black.
The report has been slammed as nonsense that flies in the face of all existing evidence. Flagged up are many issues that black and minority ethnics grapple on a daily basis. For example, the fact that black people are 9 times more likely to be stopped and searched by police than white people, and black mothers are 4 times likely to die in childbirth. So is this a genuine effort to understand racism in Britain, or a PR stunt? Many black artists share the view that racism today is alive and well. Junior from the British Collective says his life and career were deeply impacted by racism.
When I was a kid and I was growing up, if I played football and a white guy kicked me, I would have turned around and I might have effed him blind. But it wouldn't have crossed my mind to call him white. Vice versa, the first thing that he would do is turn around and say, "You black so-and-so." Not understanding for himself that he's being racist, he just took it as the norm. It hasn't changed since then. It hasn't changed in any shape, form, or fashion. I hear some politicians trying to turn it into, black politicians trying to turn it into a, oh, well, we've come a long way. We haven't.
The COVID-19 pandemic and the disproportionate number of deaths among black, Asian, and minority ethnic people clearly illustrate that something is seriously wrong. Being much more likely to have to live in a block of flats and do a job involving a high level of exposure to the public are the sort of factors that critics say prove systemic or structural racism is real. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Okay, now let's get down to business. Joining me in this debate tonight will be former Deputy Mayor of London, Lee Jasper, out of London, and also British political activist and writer Jackie Walker, who's joining us out of Kent. Good to have both of you on the show, gentlemen. Now, beginning with my first question, Lee, the opposition trade unions and campaigners have called the report shallow, naive, and politically motivated. What's your assessment of the report?
I think that assessment about sums it up. We've had a report that has been delivered by a commission that was specifically chosen by the Prime Minister and his aides, special advisors, because they were deeply sceptical and a matter of public record of being very deeply sceptical about the existence of institutional racism. And of course, as a consequence of electing a commission who had that political viewpoint, it's no surprise that we've reached this stunning conclusion. What is interesting, of course, is that the backlash to this report has been absolutely universal.
Okay. Now, Jackie, some campaigners have also described the report as a whitewash after the government commissioned, you know, report claimed that there is no evidence that the UK is institutionally racist. What's your take?
Well, it's actually worse than a whitewash, actually. This is an act of fundamental propaganda, but it has to be seen in the context of a whole range of responses that this government are making, not just to issues of race, but to issues of poverty and inequality and policing as well. I mean, what happens is, you know, there is a problem, whatever the problem is, for example, violence from police, and the government set up an inquiry, which is fixed. And we all know what the outcome is going to be. And then the outcome exonerates the police, or it exonerates government, or whatever, and that's supposed to make us feel fine. This time, I think the backlash is so strong, nobody is going to be happy with that. And in some ways, I think coming so soon after what's happened with Meghan Markle, I think this is actually, in a way, something that's quite good for the black community, because it makes it absolutely clear what our position is within British society.
Now, Lee, the British government report comes several weeks after an interview by Prince Harry and his wife, Meghan. Also, Jackie just made a mention of that. And in that, they said that the British royal family was concerned about how dark the skin of their children might be. Is it not an indication that racism is institutionalized in Britain, even at the highest level of the political establishment?
Of course. I mean, the royal family is the representation of the ultimate white supremacist royal family. I mean, there is no doubt about that. Their history is steeped in that tradition. And although they appear to say the right words in relation to the Commonwealth and diversity, the Queen has never apologized for colonialism or transatlantic slavery, never apologized, at least people of African descent and Asian descent, for their atrocities during that period. So we're very clear about the nature of the royal family, and Meghan Markle, you know, provided a bright light to that. I also think that, look, this report is falling apart at the seams. Today, that the Prime Minister's Special Race Advisor resigned as a consequence of that. Today, we've seen reported that the specialist advisors, professors, commissions, the King's Fund, which is a health inequality board, have all put out statements to say that they weren't consulted, neither did they feed in to this report, although they've been cited as doing so in it. So it's a report that is falling apart at the seams. Boris Johnson is already distancing himself from the report. His special advisor has resigned, and the black community is united in a way that I haven't, frankly, seen for a long time in opposing this government piece of propaganda. On that, Jacqueline's absolutely right.
Jackie, a 2019 Oxford University report found that black Britons and those of South Asian origin faced as much discrimination in the labor market as they did in the late 1960s and 70s. You know, black mothers have worse outcomes during pregnancy or childbirth than any other ethnic group in England. And that shows the situation in several decades later has not improved for minority groups. What do you make of these facts and figures?
Well, I mean, if you look at any range of outcomes by a huge range of organisations and academics, it totally, totally contradicts what this report is. But what's very clear is this is a very political exercise which is going on now. And I think we have to recognise that one of the reasons why that is happening is because of the lack of any real opposition now, either within the British media or actually within our political system. Because, you know, I would ask, where are our spokespeople in terms of what's supposed to be the official opposition? So what we have here is a real vacuum and a swing towards the right and a swing towards racism. I came to this country in 1959. I was part of that Windrush migration. And I have seen a lot of progress within race relations, and I've also seen a lot of backstep. I have to say, I have never known the situation to be so bad as it is now, not since I was a child.
Ali, a study by the Office of National Statistics in June 2020 found that black people are almost four times more likely to die of COVID-19, while Asians are up to twice as likely to die. And then the report 4 months later by the Office for National Statistics concludes that black people and those from South Asian ethnic backgrounds have high risks of death from COVID-19 compared to those of white ethnic backgrounds. So what's your rating of this data, and why do minority groups are hit the hardest?
Because those minority groups are affected by systemic racism that impacts upon their incomes, that has a consequent effect on their quality of life, that steeps them into long generational bouts of unemployment and poverty and child poverty. and they're in the kind of occupations that are very much public-facing, whether that's doctors within the NHS, nurses in the NHS, or whether that's people in the transport systems. And so we've seen the evidence of the collateral damage of institutionalized systemic racism being played out in our communities. And it's against that backdrop, and let's remember, against the backdrop of the rise of the Black Lives Matter movement after the death of George Floyd, that this commission was was announced. But it's done no more than completely undermine any notion that this government is taking seriously the issue of systemic racism, which is, look, you pointed it out in the facts and figures. These are matters of life and death for our community. And this report is a joke. Not only is it intellectual and incoherent, it carries no credibility, but it's actually a grievous insult to African, Caribbean and Asian communities who have lost loved ones during the course of this pandemic because of their overexposure as a result of systemic institutionalized racism and disadvantage.
Now, Jackie, we have this data by UK police indicating a rise of 300% in hate crimes against Chinese and East and Southeast Asians in the first quarter of 2020. How do you foresee this trend unfold? I mean, is the UK in a position to serve as a role model for other white majority countries as recommended in this controversial report?
I certainly don't think it can even suggest that it can be a role model. But can I just add here?
Sure.
I think we have to be really clear that the purpose of this report has got nothing to do with minorities. It has nothing to do with black people. This is not a report for black people. It's a report for the establishment, the ruling class, and the majority white community. It is so that they can feel that they don't have to actually respond to either what's happened at COVID or what's happened to Black Lives Matter. And I just want to add something which Lee Jasper brought up about issues around history and the slave trade, because it's actually worse than that. When Cameron, the Prime Minister, the late Prime Minister, went to Jamaica, one thing he said to Jamaicans was, it is time you got over that. And that is the big message of this report, not just in terms of the specific paragraphs in which they were really quite insulting, basically saying that what black people, you know, the descendants of these enslaved people should do is actually think about how great it was that we were given the opportunity to sort of remake ourselves as black and British. It's not just that. It's actually, we should forget what happened to us. Well, I have to say, we are not going to forget. It doesn't matter how much they try and change what we're taught, we will not forget, and we will keep pressing for justice.
Okay. Lee, is the British political establishment doing enough for the elimination of this issue, or is it just paying it lip service? Because, you know, Johnson was saying that there are serious issues that need to be addressed.
Well, we saw race inequality under Boris Johnson as his period of mayor in London massively increase for black Londoners. We saw civil disturbances break out as a consequence of the shooting of Mark Duggan in Tottenham by the Metropolitan Police, who said that he had a gun in his hand, and at which the inquest and subsequent inquiry proved he didn't have a gun in his hand at the point he was shot. But we know very well the tokenistic and performative responses of Boris Johnson, who for PR purposes will say anything, but is a committed hard right, extreme right, actually, libertarian free marketer. You know, he's in the category of Trump and Orban and people of this character. And represents, you know, the last gasp of white supremacists who are holding on into power. It's precisely what the melancholy exercise of Brexit is about. There's some feeble attempt to restore Britain's power and glory as a former and faded British empire. We have no doubt about Boris Johnson's not just lack of commitment to race inequality, but absolute antagonistic and hostility towards it. You know, his minister said that teaching anti-racism should be considered a crime. Teaching anti-racism in colleges and universities should be considered a crime, and that's his black minister, Kimi Badenoch. So we're under no illusions about this prime minister at all.
So, Jackie, the question is now, what can be done about this? Is the issue of racism that's occurred, is it there to stay in the UK?
Well, we're here to stay. This is our country. My children and my grandchildren are in this country, and I have a right to be here. And black people will continue to do, you know, what black people have done who are in the diaspora in Europe and in the Americas, which is we will continue to struggle for our own emancipation, and we'll do that with our white allies, of which we have many, and we will fight for a socialist and radical change of government.
Mm-hmm. And Lee, what's your prediction? What do you foresee could be happening in the future weeks and months to come? Could like movements and demonstrations like BLM happen also in the UK?
I think we'll see a massive explosion of Black Lives Matter protests. We've had recent deaths in custody here in the UK, in Wales, of Mohammed Hassan and Moyed Bashir. We've had massive examples of police oppression taking place in arrest of Black Lives Matter protesters. I think we're going to see a summer of discontent in this country. I think that this is a direct provocation by this government in terms of this report. It's a declaration of war on black people and anti-racists. And I think here Johnson has, to use a Jamaican proverb, has hung his hat where his hand can't reach it. And the consequences of that will be massive Black Lives Matter demonstrations throughout the summer. That's what I would hope. That's what I'll be working for. And that's what we'll start putting on the streets actually from tomorrow in Parliament Square.
And Jackie, is it only this government or maybe some other government in future? Maybe they could do something about racism. Are you optimistic?
I'm optimistic because I think we always have to be optimistic for change. But I don't expect change to come easily. We're never given our freedoms. Equality is never offered to us. We are ruled by a tiny elite. Who own most of the wealth in this country, and they're certainly not going to give that up easily. But we will do as we have always done, which is to struggle against them, you know. So I'm optimistic that in the end, we will better our situation. Am I short-term optimistic? I'm optimistic that we will fight against this government. Am I optimistic that the opposition or other formal political parties will assist us in this way? No, I'm not. The change will come from the street.
And Lee, your final comments?
I think the change will come from the streets. You know, we've seen Black Lives Matter movement around the world do more, push the dial on racism in a way that all of the political parties, liberal democratic parties, done over the last 20 years and seen astounding progress in very many areas. So I think the signal to our communities is clear. Just as in climate change, just as in the anti-racism movement, and it's when you go on the streets, when you mass protest, is when you achieve the greatest and radical change. And I think that because we're guaranteed the support of the majority of people in this country to put that message on the street, change is almost inevitable.
On that note, we come to the end of this debate show. Let me thank our guests. We had former Deputy Mayor of London, Lee Jasper, who joined us from London, also British political activist and writer Jackie Walker, who joined us out of Kent with their insight and comments.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Savior.
Oh, the Savior of mankind, please show us the sign.
To the designer of the human civilization that is established on the unity of Almighty Allah.
You are a true God.
To the redeemer of human volition and thought.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful, may Allah's peace and blessings be upon the Holy Prophet of Islam, Muhammad, and his immaculate progeny, dear and sisters all over the world. Assalamu alaikum and welcome to The Last Savior from IRIB English Radio. In this series of shows, we are trying to answer some doubts or misconceptions on the very important issue and concept of Mahdawiyya or Mahdism. In this series of shows, we have been trying to answer the doubts or misconceptions raised by a so-called scholar from extremist groups on this important topic of Mahdawiyya. The concept of Mahdawiyya is something that has been universally accepted by different religions, not only Islam. In different religions, Abrahamic religions, we see the expectation and waiting concept for the whole followers of religions. They are waiting for a last savior to come to save the humanity and save the world. So this is not something to be easily denied. That's why in this series of shows we are trying to analyze this concept and the issues around it meticulously through the eyes of the school of Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam. In this very show we shall focus on one misconception which says that narrations and traditions or hadith regarding Mahdawiyya, regarding the beginning of occultation, looks contradictory. This is what we are going to ask from the respected guest speaker, Sheikh Murtada Karimi from Qom Seminary Schools, to shed some light and tell us what the reality is. Sheikh, assalamu alaikum and welcome to the show.
Wa alaikum assalam and thank you for having me.
Many thanks for accepting the invitation. Sheikh, the first question that we need to ask and discuss is the same topic that I introduced in the beginning, that is the narrations and traditions of Mahdawiyya talking about the beginning of occultation or ghibah look contradictory. Is it true, Sheikh? Some say that Imam started his occultation 3 days after his birth, some say 40 days, some say 7 days. So which is true, and is it basically an innate contradiction in this series of hadith or not?
We know that Imam al-Mahdi, may Allah hasten his reappearance, according to the Shia school of thought, he has two occultations, the minor one and the major occultation. Now, about the beginning of the minor occultation, most of the Shia scholars believe that it begins from the year, from the day Imam al-Askari alayhi salam was martyred, that is the year 260 after Hijra. And some Shia scholars believe that it begins from the day Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam was born, the year 255. But all agree that it was ended in the year 329, and then the major occultation began. But what is mentioned in this doubt is not related to this difference among the Shia scholars. Rather, this Wahhabi scholar tries to prove that still, I mean, he is mentioning different points to come to this conclusion that Mahdi, which is viewed by the Shia as the last Imam, is nothing but a myth. There is no reality about him. And he says that one of the reasons is that there are differences and contradictions in Shia narrations about the time that people were not able to see him anymore. Now, in this doubt, he mentions four narrations, and he says that there are contradictions in these four narrations. And he says that in the first narration, we read that Hakima Khatun, she says that 3 days after the birth of Mahdi, I was eager to see him, so I went to the house of Imam al-Askari alayhi salam. I went into the room where his mother was lying, but I was not able to see him. And then Imam al-Askari alayhi salam told me about the fact that he is under the protection of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and through the permission of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, people can see him. So this is the first narration according to which 3 days after his birth, Hakima was not able to see him.
True.
Then according to another narration, after 7 days, Hakima was not able to see him. According to another narration, Hakima says that I saw Mahdi after 40 days and he was walking in the house and I did not see him after that.
Logically, if there are different narrations on the timing, it doesn't necessarily actually reach to this conclusion that there is no occultation or no occultation had happened. So, I mean, logically speaking, this conclusion has no relation to the introduction that was made. So, I mean, let's now hear from you. What is the exact, I don't know, what is the true understanding from a hadith that what day Imam actually started occultation?
That's true. So, regarding these narrations that this Wahhabi scholar has mentioned, first of all, the first answer is that all these narrations are weak. I can mention that in the